The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today on the program, Robert Dalek returns. He's just published a book called Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. Welcome back, sir.
Pleasure to be with you.
Robert, you've done a lot of presidential biographies, but you seem to be particularly interested in FDR. What is it about Franklin Delano Roosevelt that you find so compelling?
Well, he was, there's a consensus that he was one of the three great presidents of American history and certainly the greatest president of the 20th century of modern American history, along with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. And also, it seems to me that in this time of general disillusionment with our politics, and I think the Congress has about a single-digit approval rating. Donald Trump seems to run at about 35-36% approval, which is the lowest of any first-year president since we've been polling going back to the 1930s. And Roosevelt, I think it's well for us to remember that you can have great leadership. Now, it's true, these times are very different, but, you know, we're still the same country, and the way Roosevelt pioneered the use of the medium of radio, and John Kennedy used the television, having live televised press conferences, and Donald Trump now has used this new social medium with tweeting, that Roosevelt used radio. But it's not just having the insight and judgment to use a modern medium to reach an audience, but you have to have a message and a voice that resonates with millions of people across the country, because Roosevelt's objective was to build a consensus. He was always mindful of the fact that if you did not have a consensus in a democracy, you couldn't govern very effectively. And that was particularly true with the World War, that if you're going to sacrifice blood and treasure, you needed to have a stable consensus to lead the country.
We've had so many books written about Roosevelt. What did you feel you could offer in this one that was new and different?
Well, I felt that there are so many young people who have never read a biography of FDR and have lived in a time when there's such a negative impulse about politicians and politics, office holders, and that it would be well for them to read a book about how a truly effective president functioned. Now, this is not to suggest that Franklin Roosevelt was a saint. He had his limitations, and historians have given ample coverage to all this. His New Deal didn't end the Depression. It was industrial mobilization that did that. But, of course, his New Deal did something as, if not more important. It humanized the American industrial system with those alphabet agencies, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, that insured lifetime savings bank accounts, the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA, that turned a poor region of the Upper South into a much more prosperous area, Wages and Hours Bill that guaranteed minimum wage and maximum hours, Social Security so that people would have old age pensions, unemployment insurance, because when he came to office, 25 million people were unemployed. There was a sense of desperation in the country. Men would forage through garbage cans near restaurants late at night to see if they could find some edible food, which they could maybe also bring home to their families. A million men were riding the rails around the country in search of some kind of employment, some kind of return on their work. Young women in the textile industry in New England would earn 7.5 cents an hour. And if they could work a 10-hour day and make 75 cents, it was seen as nearly a princely sum. Mm. And so there was a sense of desperation in the country, and Roosevelt restored hope. How do you do this? How do you go about doing it? And I think there are lessons from Roosevelt. The fireside chats, he'd get on the radio, he'd close his eyes before the microphone and imagine himself sitting in the living room with your family, speaking to you as if he were paterfamilias, as if he were a close friend of your family. It was so resonated because after he died, somebody stopped Mrs. Roosevelt on the street and said to her, "I miss the way your husband used to speak to me about my government." Or the man who stood by the railroad track while the funeral train was going by, moving from Warm Springs, Georgia, where he died, to his burial in Hyde Park, New York. And the man was sobbing, and somebody said to him, "Did you know the president?" And he said, "No, but he knew me." Now, it's so telling as to how he connected to millions of people in this country with a message of hope. And I think they believed that he had recovered from his polio, from his disability. Of course, there are no photographs of him demonstrating his immobility, that he was confined to a wheelchair, that as he himself said when he returned from the Yalta Conference, "I carried 10 pounds of steel around each of my lower limbs," you see. But people had lost track of that. They thought he had recovered, and it was a kind of metaphor for the country itself, a feeling that, look, if he had fought through this disease and recovered, he can really lead the country to recover from this terrible economic collapse.
Before we go into our first break in the Book Nook this morning, I'm going to bring you a little bonus, an audiobook excerpt from a recording made by Rick Adamson of the book Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. And we're going to hear the portion in which we learn how Franklin D. Roosevelt got polio.
In the spring and summer of 1921, although Franklin and Howe were considering a possible 1922 U.S. Senate campaign, high office was a mirage on the horizon. Settling into his new work routine and blunting an ongoing Senate subcommittee attack on his part and the Navy's response to the Newport scandal commanded his attention. In the middle of July, he returned to Washington to refute committee accusations that he had organized and directed the entrapment of homosexual sailors by disgraceful actions. Although the allegations ended up as one-day newspaper stories having little resonance, the anxiety of having to deal with such unpleasantness drained his energies. At the end of July, he welcomed the opportunity to escape a steamy Manhattan for a Boy Scout outing in upstate New York at Bear Mountain, where he acted as a toastmaster. When he arrived at Hyde Park on July 29th, his secretary, Marguerite Missy LeHand, thought he seemed exhausted, worn down by the tensions over the Newport case, the summer heat, and the demands of performing at the Boy Scout conclave. He was more than ready to escape to Campobello on August 5th by sailing to Maine with friends on a 140-foot power yacht docked in New York Harbor. As the most experienced sailor aboard, Franklin took the helm to steer the yacht through treacherous cross currents along the Maine coast, an exhilarating but exhausting task that brought the crew safely into harbor on August 8th. When he woke early on the morning of August 9th, he faced another day of nonstop activity that further tested his reserves of energy. Deep sea fishing with his friends on the power yacht occupied the hours from dawn to late afternoon, and during the outing, he slipped overboard while moving back and forth on the slippery deck and had to be helped back onto the boat. The water was so cold, he said, it seemed paralyzing. It was an apt metaphor, for apparently at some point in the previous 2 weeks, the incubation period for poliovirus, he had contracted the potentially crippling disease. At that time, less than 1% of infected adults the age of 30 and older suffered lasting damage. The 39-year-old Roosevelt was one of the unlucky few. Today, our much greater understanding of the disease suggests that Franklin's weariness had weakened his immune system and facilitated the virus's path through his body. On August 10th, despite feeling oddly depleted, he began another day of nonstop physical activity, sailing with Eleanor and the older children on his 25-foot yacht, joining volunteers to beat back a fire on a nearby island, and trotting a mile and a half from the Roosevelt's home across the 3-mile-wide Campobello to a swimming hole, followed by another run to a beach for a dip in the ocean, and a final run back to the house. Feeling totally spent, achy, and chilled, Franklin skipped dinner and went to bed. A devotee of Cousin Theodore's strenuous life, Franklin, despite periodic bouts of illness, prided himself on his physical stamina and healthy living, which allowed him to follow a regimen of hard work and rigorous exercise. He could not imagine a life without sailing, fishing, golfing, horseback riding, and hiking. Surely he was suffering from nothing more than a bad cold or flu, and would recover as quickly as he had from past afflictions. On the morning of August 11th, he was running a 102-degree temperature and complained of severe pain in the back of both legs. The doctor from the nearby village of Lubeck, Maine, thought he was dealing with a nasty summer cold. By the next morning, though, the pain was worse, and by evening, Franklin had lost the ability to stand. He was paralyzed from the waist down. Louis Howe, who had agreed to work for Franklin again after ending his Navy Department service, was living with his family in Campobello. Franklin's worsening condition alarmed him. Accurately guessing that he could find a specialist vacationing in one of Maine's coastal cities, which were a magnet for wealthy northeastern businessmen and professionals, Howe reached a Dr. William Keene, an 84-year-old surgeon and faculty member of Philadelphia's Jefferson Medical College, who had performed surgery on President Grover Cleveland. Keene readily agreed to make the 101-mile trip from Bar Harbor to see Franklin. Arriving on Saturday evening, August 13th, Keene performed a close examination, which persuaded him that a blood clot had formed in Franklin's lower spine. The good news, however, was that it would dissolve in time, though it might take several months, after which Franklin could expect to be as mobile as ever. In the meantime, Keene instructed Eleanor and Hal to massage Franklin's legs vigorously to help dissolve the clot. In a 2013 book that persuasively reconstructs the onset and course of Roosevelt's illness, James Tobin concludes that Keene's judgment was wrong in every detail. The massaging caused excruciating pain and may have further damaged Franklin's leg muscles, though it could have also averted life-threatening clots. Less than a week after his visit, Keene changed his diagnosis, writing Eleanor that the problem was probably not a clot, but an inflammation of the spinal cord that would take many months to subside. He was mistaken about this as well. In the meantime, Howe, who had a variety of health problems and whose own experience with many physicians had made him a skeptic about medical judgments, saw the need for another opinion. Keene, after all, was a surgeon, not a diagnostician. Howe wisely viewed Keene's assessment as vague and was concerned that he had already changed his diagnosis. Howe reached out to Fred Delano, Franklin's uncle, who immediately got in touch with a Dr. Parker in Washington, D.C. Parker thought that the illness might be infantile paralysis, a disease that normally afflicted children but was not unknown in adults. He advised Delano to consult with specialists on poliomyelitis at Boston's Peter Bent Brigham Hospital. Delano rushed to Boston, where he met with Dr. Samuel Levine, a young physician who had observed numerous polio cases. Levine recommended an immediate spinal tap, which could clarify the diagnosis. When Eleanor told Keene of Levine's advice, he very strenuously objected to the proposal for a lumbar puncture, though he called Dr. Robert Lovett, one of the medical directors of the Brigham Infantile Paralysis Clinic, who agreed to travel to Campobello. His examination of Franklin on August 24th convinced him of the need for the spinal tap almost 2 weeks after Franklin had first manifested symptoms of illness. The results, cloudy spinal fluid signaling a concentration of white blood cells and an infection, made it perfectly clear that Franklin's paralysis was caused by poliomyelitis. Could Franklin regain the use of his legs? Would he ever walk again unaided, or would he face a life of immobility? Lovett explained that no one could give definitive answers to these questions so early in the course of the illness, but his experience with the disease indicated that Franklin did not have the severest type and that disability was not to be feared, apparently meaning that Franklin would somehow be able to get around. Whether out of dogged optimism in response to Lovett's assessment, or a desire to put a brave face to the world so that he would not be out of consideration as a future office holder, Franklin wrote his law partner, Langdon Marvin, "I am almost wholly out of commission as to my legs, but the doctors say that there is no question that I will get their use back again, though this means several months of treatment in New York."
Robert Dalek joins us. His new book is Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. This is a massive book. It's over 600 pages. You take us through the early years quickly, but you take us through his days in prep school, his days as an only child. His father was much older than his mother. He was devastated when his father died. You show us how he met his wife, Eleanor, and the kids that they had together, and how that marriage really became strained when she discovered that he was having an affair. And it was a difficult marriage. She didn't want him to run for elective office. He could have become a lawyer, but there was something in him that drove him. We look at his early days. He served in the government during World War I of President Woodrow Wilson. And I keep seeing parallels between Woodrow Wilson and FDR as I read your book. They both had these health issues that were hidden, that were concealed. They were both isolationists, trying to keep us out of wars. They wanted to found these groups. Woodrow wanted the League of Nations, and FDR wanted the United Nations. I see so many parallels between them. Yet FDR, he was a consummate politician. He had to be one of the greatest politicians. The only guy I think I could compare with him would be Abe Lincoln as far as his ability to bring people together.
I think you're absolutely right that what served him so well was that he had this brilliant intuitive feel for political mood and understanding in the country. You know, he would be a half step, a quarter step ahead of public opinion, and he would articulate the feeling of the moment, and it served him brilliantly. And he was like his cousin Theodore, who was enormously popular also, and during Theodore's time, there were no polls. He measured public mood by his own astute judgment of where the public was at. And Franklin had a lot of that, too. Yes, polling began in the mid-1930s, and it was there for Roosevelt right through the end of his presidency in April 1945 when he died. But he relied upon Eleanor, upon other members of his government who traveled the country, and he himself would take these trips around the country, inspection tours, he called them, and what he was doing in part was assessing public mood, getting a feel for the grassroots sentiment in the country, and it served him brilliantly, because, as I said, he understood that without a consensus, without the backing of the public, in that sense, he was a great Democrat with a small D. When he first came to the office and there was such economic dislocation and misery, there were some people telling him that maybe he should take dictatorial powers. After all, to rely on 500-plus people in a Congress that was going to, as always, have a hard time agreeing on anything much, and certainly on any major transformations, he should step up and take concentrated power. And he wouldn't do it because he said he feared that it would cause fundamental damage to our democracy. So in that sense, he was a great Democratic politician with a small D, and it served them brilliantly. And as I always tell my students, nobody can teach you how to be a great politician. There is an instinctive, intuitive feel for this. And Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, they certainly both had it.
He really didn't let people know what he was thinking. He had this this wonderful, confident exterior facade that he gave to everybody, and you really didn't know what he was thinking or how much pain he might have been in. You do a splendid job of showing us, first of all, how the polio hit him and what sort of exacerbated that, and then he was able somehow to gather his strength and get elected to the highest office in the land. And he talked to somebody at one point where he said, I come into my office and he's essentially a prisoner at his desk. He can't get up. Yes. They've moved him in here. Yep. He has to sit at that desk all day long. And
that's right.
You really made me feel for him. When I got to the end of the book at 3 o'clock in the morning last night and I read about his death, I cried.
Oh, my. Well, yes, it is a very moving story because the guy was courageous, and the man was courageous, and he had, though, this buoyant quality to himself. And, you know, Winston Churchill said meeting Franklin Roosevelt for the first time was uncorking a bottle of champagne. See, there was a certain bubbly and buoyant quality to him, and he conveyed that to the public, and the public desperately needed it. You know, Herbert Hoover, Roosevelt's predecessor in the office, said that if only there were a song, a poem, a joke that could be told that would raise the country's spirits. So Hoover understood this, but he never found it. Now, Roosevelt, when he was running, his popular song at first was Anchors Away, to celebrate the connection he had to the Navy Department. He had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy, but they changed it to Happy Days Are Here Again, and it was a very shrewd change to give him a kind of connection to a better future, because that was absolutely essential to give. And that was the first thing he did as president. You know, he gave this fireside chat about the banking crisis. Did he call it a crisis, a malaise? No, of course not. He said, we're going to have a banking holiday, uh-huh. Say, go out, have a good time, have picnics, whatever. And the whole outlook was upbeat, was positive, you see, and that was part of his political genius, to reinstill the feeling of hope and excitement about America's virtues and its the power of its democratic system. And my feeling is Roosevelt's a model in that sense, and somebody will come along again to imitate him, and never in the same way, and they won't call it a New Deal, and they won't be exactly like Roosevelt, but they'll understand that the underlying importance of unifying the country and of being positive about its traditions and its institutions, and it'll recreate a sense of excitement the way John Kennedy did with A New Frontier.
Robert Dalek joins us. His book is Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. You just alluded to that statement that Winston Churchill made comparing meeting Roosevelt to the popping of the champagne cork. And that reminded me when I was reading your book, I remembered early on when Roosevelt and Churchill actually met for the first time. It was during World War I, and they were both lower-ranking members of their governments. And Roosevelt apparently was miffed later on that Churchill didn't actually recall meeting him the first time.
That's right. He was a minor official, and Churchill was the First Lord of the Admiralty, and Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and Churchill was sort of above and beyond him. And but later on, and especially after Roosevelt died, he knew he had lost this extraordinary partner in the struggle to defeat the awful forces that were combating democracy at the time, and fascism and Nazism and Japanese militarism.
One of the things I enjoy about your books is you find these little incidents that you include, and I never know, is this something that's well known or is this something that he found? And one of those involved, it's late in the book, and Charles de Gaulle is in Washington, and he's not a happy man. Roosevelt isn't treating him with the respect he feels he deserves. And at one point, a congressman plays a trick on de Gaulle with a trick cigar.
Right.
That cracked me up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there are some funny moments in that book, when particularly my favorite is when Ben Cohen, member of the Brain Trust, advisor on legislation, came into the Oval Office, and Roosevelt was chuckling, and Cohen said, Mr. President, would you mind sharing the joke with me? Huh. And Roosevelt said, okay, Ben, Eleanor was just in here, and she had been to her doctor this morning for a physical, and when she came in, I said to her, so, Eleanor, what did the doctor have to say about that big ass of yours? And she replied, oh, Franklin, he had nothing at all to say about you.
Oh, so. Yes. I would have brought that up, but I was going to leave that. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, she was quick. Today, speaking of Eleanor, I believe that today, as we are recording this interview, I believe it was 55 years ago today that they had the funeral of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was quite a power unto herself. And she was the voice of liberalism in his administration. And, you know, he was cautious with African Americans, for example. He would never openly come out and back the anti-lynching legislation that progressives in the Congress wanted him to support, because there was so many lynchings across the South and abuse of African Americans and their civil liberties. But the irony is that by the end of his presidency in 1945, the majority of blacks had moved from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party, and the saying had become, turn Lincoln's face to the wall, because Roosevelt's New Deal its many programs had filtered down to African Americans and made them ever since members of supporters of the Democratic Party. Not all of them, of course, but a majority of blacks to this day vote for the Democrats.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. We have another audiobook bonus for you as we go into this second break from the recording made by Rick Adamson. This is Franklin D. Roosevelt dealing with issues right before the outbreak of World War II and the U.S. involvement in that war.
In his preoccupation with British survival, Roosevelt had said relatively little in public about Japan. He wanted, as Churchill had urged, to keep the Japanese dog quiet in the Pacific, and he hoped that the presence of naval forces in Pearl Harbor could serve as a deterrent to Tokyo. His inclusion of Japan in his speech as one of the nations seeking world control, and his mention of China as serving as a great defense against Japan and the presence of the American fleet in the Pacific, therefore marked a departure. Ever since the war had erupted in Europe in September 1939, he had struggled with how to contain Japan without provoking a Pacific conflict that would divert the United States and Britain from addressing the German threat. His cabinet had become a battleground of proposals for how to deal with Tokyo, with Ickes, Morgenthau, and Stimson urging economic embargoes on scrap metals and high-grade aviation fuel to deprive Japan's military of key products and impede its three-year-old war in China, and Hull's State Department cautioning against economic measures that could impel Tokyo toward seizure of French and Dutch-controlled resource-rich areas in Southeast Asia. In July 1940, Ickes complained that Hull and his State Department subordinates were appeasers, and that any consideration of Hull as a presidential candidate was a terrible idea. "He would make a rotten president," Ickes told Roosevelt. Ickes found it difficult to understand how the president can put up with the State Department. As for Hull, Ickes complained, "The fellow can't think straight, and he is totally lacking in imagination. If we had embargoed scrap and petroleum products 2 or 3 years ago, Japan would not be in the position that it is, and our position relative to Japan, as well as that of England, would be infinitely stronger." In July 1940, Roosevelt took a middle ground, agreeing to increased oil shipments to Japan from the Dutch East Indies as a way to restrain it from a seizure of the vulnerable Dutch colony. At the same time, however, after Japanese forces had occupied part of French Indochina and Tokyo signed its tripartite agreement with Germany and Italy, he consented to a full embargo on all iron and steel scrap exports to Japan. But he refused to include oil in the embargo and directed Morgenthau to stop pressing him on the matter, with his Navy chiefs warning that the Pacific Fleet was unprepared for offensive operations, and General Marshall also cautioning against provoking Tokyo into a war, Roosevelt decided it was wiser to exercise restraint and not incite Japanese aggression, while at the same time displaying sufficient indications of resolve to make Tokyo understand that if pressed too hard, the United States would turn its superior military power against Japan. As 1940 came to an end, those closest to Roosevelt wondered if he had the stamina to bear the burdens of a world that now seemed to be in perpetual crisis. The physical toll that the demands of the presidency had taken on him was all too evident. As he prepared to take the oath of office again, his consideration for his physical well-being paled alongside the larger obligations that demanded his continued service, not just to the nation, but to the very principles the country represented. The poet Archibald MacLeish expressed Roosevelt's feelings articulately when he wrote him, "In the face of our danger which confronts our time, no individual retains or can hope to retain the rights of personal choice which free men can enjoy in times of peace. He has a first obligation to serve in defense of our institutions of freedom, a first obligation to serve his country in whatever capacity his country finds him useful, which must override all personal preferences." Harold Laski, the British political theorist and Labour Party leader, asked Supreme Court Associate Justice Felix Frankfurter to tell Roosevelt that fascism is so literally the enemy of mankind that there is no price that you can pay for its destruction that is too high.
The Book Nook continues on WYSO with our final segment with Robert Dalek. Okay, Robert, you've strayed into the area of his faults. I think the one that some of our listeners are probably thinking of is the concentration camps, not the ones that he didn't liberate, but the ones he created.
Right. Yep. There were, of course, one of his flaws, as it's been recalled, were the concentration camps, as he called them. That was the term he used for the incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans, 90% of whom were American citizens. And he was doing something that he felt struck resonant chords with millions of Americans. Remember that at the beginning of the war, Pearl Harbor had been devastated. Much of the fleet had been destructed in Hawaii. The Japanese had moved out across the Pacific and captured Guam and Wake Island, and they were moving down against the New Zealand and Australia. Their victories over capturing the Solomon Islands and striking into New Guinea. And Roosevelt needed at the beginning of the war some way to strike back against the Japanese. And, of course, there was the famous Jimmy Doolittle raid that they altered the engines on these bombers so that they could fly off of aircraft carriers 600 miles away from Tokyo and then strike the Japanese capital and home islands, you see. And that was a sense of striking back at Japan. But the other way was to incarcerate Japanese Americans. Now, of course, the American Civil Liberties Union later said it was the greatest breach of civil liberties in American history. But at the time, Roosevelt, in a sense, used it as a way to create a sense of momentum in striking back against the Japanese, you see. But it shadows his presidency ever since, as does his response to the Holocaust, that to this day people complain about the fact that he never ordered the bombing of the railway lines into Auschwitz, that he spoke out about the Holocaust, but that there were no major changes to the immigration laws that might have allowed for Jews trying to escape from Hitler's concentration camps and destruction of European Jewry. And Roosevelt responded to the fact that there was a lot of anti-Semitism and fierce anti-immigrant attitudes, opinion in the United States. There was fear that at the end of the war, we're going to slip back into another depression, and that we let all sorts of immigrants in, that they were going to become a burden on the economy and the budget and the country. And but Roosevelt is criticized for having failed to exercise the kind of moral leadership that at least could have given him, even if he couldn't have put it across politically, at least give him standing as someone who used the bully pulpit to make the moral case against the Nazis during the war.
You're listening to The Book Nook. My guest is Robert Dalek. His new book is Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. As we get to the end, and Roosevelt, he didn't really want to run for a third term. He was already overwhelmed and increasingly unwell. And the miracle of him running for a fourth term and winning and just barely living long enough to start that fourth term, it's amazing to read just how terribly ill he was, and yet he would revivify whenever he would get into a political discussion or something. It would get him going. Yeah. But man, he was going out. He was having all kinds of problems, wasn't he?
It was as early as 1940 when he sat in his Hyde Park home taking in the results of the election. He suddenly broke out in a cold sweat and was in terrible pain and said to his Secret Service agent, close the door, don't let anybody in. And subsequent to that, he would occasionally lie on the floor writhing in pain. He was having these angina attacks, and he had terrible hypertension and was suffering from congestive heart failure, which then caught up with him in April 1945. In February 45, when he was at the Yalta Conference, Winston Churchill's physician, Lord Moran, recorded in a diary that the president has hardening of the arteries of the brain. He will be dead in 3 months' time, and he called it right on the mark. But, you know, Roosevelt knew he was quite ill and might not make it through a fourth term. In fact, what he understood was that in 1944, the polls showed that people wanted him to run again as long as the war continued. Once the war were over, if the war was over, they didn't want him to be president anymore. But they wanted him there until the war was at an end. And what he talked about was the possibility that he's running for a fourth term. If he wins, he will only stay for about a year till the war was over, and then he'd resign, and he wanted to be the head of an international peace organization. But, of course, he would never have the chance to do that because he died after a few months in his fourth term. But on the other hand, there were 50 million plus people who perished in World War II, some 25 million probably in the Soviet Union. 420,000 Americans were killed in the fighting. And the attitude on Roosevelt's part was that it's been so much sacrifice that if I'm giving my life, I'm just part of the whole World War II generation that pays the price for the defense of our freedoms.
When I see photos of FDR, I'm always struck by how he exuded this confidence, this infectious confidence. And when I look at pictures of President Trump before he became president, he had that same kind of smiling confidence. But I don't see that anymore. He seems to scowl a lot. He seems to have a very thin skin. I wish he would read this book. I think he could get something out of this book.
Well, if you can get him to read it, I will be a very happy man because I think you're right. You know, he doesn't seem to understand that this kind of dour and combative approach. You know, it's one thing to be combative behind the scenes, which all presidents are, and but to do it so much in public is really destructive to national unity and to your standing with the public. And indeed, you know, Donald Trump's standing is the lowest of any president since in a first year. Since we've had the public opinion polling, after 9-10 months in the office, to have 36% approval rating, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, in all the time he was there, never went below 50% approval rating. But Trump has never reached 50% in his first year, which is a striking example of how ineffective he is in creating unity and creating a majority support for himself.
Well, sir, I think I'm going to get on Twitter this afternoon and send President Trump a tweet with the suggestion that he reads Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life by Robert Dallek.
Well, I hope he responds. Thank you.
I doubt if he does, but hey, you know, it's worth a try. It's so good to talk to you. So good to talk to you again. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Today, my guest was Robert Dalek, his book, Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. And we've been giving you some bonus tracks from the audiobook version, read by Rick Adamson. And we're going to close out the program today with the ending of the book as Dalek talks about two of the big faults in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration. Here we go now with the end of the audiobook in the Book Nook.
Roosevelt's placement of Japanese Americans in what he himself called concentration camps was characterized after the war by the American Civil Liberties Union as the greatest breach of civil liberties in American history. Mindful of the anger of Americans in the wake of the Pearl Harbor attack, Roosevelt set aside his reservations about this violation of the Constitution. Allowing Japanese Americans to volunteer for military service, where they served with great distinction in the battles to defeat German forces in Italy, could not redress the balance in the abuse of their rights. Recent proposals to round up American Muslims have recalled the injustice visited on Americans of Japanese descent decades ago and Roosevelt's expediency in the matter. No issue in Roosevelt's legacy remains as contested as his response to the Holocaust, Hitler's annihilation of 6 million Jews. As Blanche Wiesen Cook wrote in the third volume of her splendid Eleanor Roosevelt biography, debates over FDR's indifference to the Jewish slaughter will surely continue. Those who argue that FDR did everything possible are contradicted by ER's assertion that nobody did all they could have. We let our consciences realize too late the need of standing up against something that we knew was wrong. In 2003, when Cook asked Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Roosevelt biographer and John Kennedy White House advisor, how can you argue that FDR did everything possible to rescue and save the perishing? Schlesinger responded by pointing to the realities of American politics of the era in which anti-Semitism was prevalent. Look at the numbers, he said. 30% of the U.S. population was German-American, the Democratic Party was Irish, Italian, and Southern. There was no congressional support to save the Jews, no movement to save them, an intense division among Jewish leaders, many of whom remained silent throughout. Silence, denial, complicity. While Schlesinger makes a compelling case for Roosevelt's reluctance to risk political capital in what appeared to be an unwinnable battle, the moral question of his failure to do everything possible in the face of such an unprecedented and heinous crime cannot be brushed aside with a justification of the realities of political circumstances. If bombing the railway lines into Auschwitz, as many have suggested, might not have stopped the slaughter, it would at least be remembered as a genuine attempt to achieve a worthy end. Roosevelt's caution in dealing with cross-currents regarding allowing greater numbers of Hitler's persecuted peoples into the United States also raises questions about his political courage when faced with a potentially unpopular policy. When he put Breckinridge Long in charge of issuing visas to desperate victims of Nazi persecution, he tacitly closed off avenues of escape for many who perished in Hitler's concentration camps. Under the National Origins Act, Long's resistance to facilitating the legal migration to America of roughly 125,000 additional victims of Hitler's madness remains an ugly mark on Roosevelt's presidency. Only after Henry Morgenthau confronted him in the 1944 election with the political consequences of keeping Long at his post, the potential loss of Jewish votes in New York, and defeat in a state crucial to his re-election, did Roosevelt remove him and agree to set up the War Refugee Board, which rescued some Jews in Romania, France, and Hungary. Yet, even with these failings, Roosevelt's stature as one of the country's greatest and most respected leaders cannot be denied. He offered the best judgment of his own achievements in comments he made in his 1936 acceptance address at the Democratic Convention. Governments can err. Presidents do make mistakes. But the immortal Dante tells us that divine justice weighs the sins of the cold-blooded and the sins of the warm-hearted in different scales. better the occasional faults of a government that lives in a spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference. It remains a guidepost, as Roosevelt himself does, for every administration and every president who takes up the responsibility of leading our democratic republic.